Welcome to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. Medical professionals like me are actually pretty poor guides to nutrition. In my medical schooling, for example, we had 1 week out of 4 years spent on nutrition science, despite the fact that eating is one of three behaviors that most dictates our overall health, the others being exercise and smoking, as in not smoking. My guest today, Dr. Michael Greger, was appalled by the lack of formal curriculum time devoted to nutrition and sought out the medical school most committed to it, the Tufts School of Medicine. Inspired by the medical odyssey of his grandmother, Dr. Greger has given his life and career over to promoting the health importance of good nutrition as manifest by a plant-based diet. He's the author of several books, and his newest, with the catchy title How Not to Die, is a runaway bestseller. The first half of the book is a look at the scientific literature around plant-based eating in specific disease categories. As you might expect, Greger touts vegetarianism for nearly all ills, but his examples and data are compelling. The second half of the book is a list of his superfoods, complete with recommendations for particular foods and recipes that you can use to eat more healthily. Greger is the force behind the website nutritionfacts.org, and all his book and website proceeds are donated to charity. He spends much of his time traveling the country and spreading the gospel of plant-based nutrition, and he's a persuasive speaker, as you can see by looking at any of the numerous videos on his website. Dr. Michael Greger, author of How Not to Die, Discover the Foods Scientifically Proven to Prevent and Reverse Disease, is my guest today on Studio Tulsa. Michael Greger, welcome to Studio Tulsa on Health. I want to start by really where your book starts, asking you the story of your grandmother, which is pretty compelling and really gave you the inspiration, I think, for your whole career.
Yeah, so that's why I'm a doctor, why I practice the kind of medicine that I started practicing. You know, I was just a kid, really, when the doctor sent my grandma home in a wheelchair to die, essentially. She was diagnosed with end-stage heart disease, basically had so many bypass operations, she kind of run out of plumbing, get all scarred up inside. Confined in a wheelchair, crushing chest pain, nothing more they could do. Her life was over at age 65. But then she heard about this guy, Nathan Pritikin, one of our early lifestyle medicine pioneers, and became one of her kind of early success stories. She's even featured in Pritikin's biography. It talks about Francis Greger, my grandma. It's kind of a live-in program where everyone's placed on a kind of plant-based diet and started on an exercise regimen. They wheeled her in, and she walked out. Within a few weeks, she was walking 10 miles a day, went on to live another 31 years till age 96 to continue to enjoy her six grandkids, including me. Her miraculous recovery not only inspired one of those grandkids to pursue a career in medicine, but really granted her enough healthy years to see him graduate from medical school. So it's really all kind of thanks to her that I went down the path that I did.
So there were no doctors in your family?
My mom's a nurse. My mom was a home health nurse. And so that gave me kind of personal in-home experience of what it was like to be in the profession in general. But beyond that, I think that's the only kind of medical figure anywhere.
So were there other reasons besides, you mentioned your mother's a nurse, that led you specifically to sort of plant-based diet as part of your solution? I mean, you do also mention that you sought out specifically, and physicians, myself included, are usually quite poor in our knowledge of nutrition because we spend so little time in medical school being educated about it. But you sought out Tufts Medical School because your research taught you that of all the medical schools in the U.S., that one had perhaps the most curriculum devoted to nutrition science.
Yeah, you know, doctors, you have this severe nutrition deficiency in education. You know, most doctors are just never taught, you know, the impact healthy nutrition can have on the course of illness, and so we graduate without this powerful tool in our medical toolbox. Now, there are, you know, institutional barriers, too, time constraints, lack of reimbursement, and general doctors simply aren't paid for counseling people on how to take better care of themselves. Of course, drug companies also play a role in influencing medical education and practice. Your listeners can ask, you know, their doctors when's the last time they were taken out to dinner by Big Broccoli. Probably been a while. I chose Tufts Med because they had 19 hours of nutrition training. That's out of thousands of hours of preclinical instruction, though, but they have a graduate, the Francis Stern School of Nutrition there, kind of on the campus. I was hoping I'd have kind of better access to some of the resources there. But this is all before it was really became kind of populated in the medical literature, before Dr. Dean Ornish published his landmark lifestyle heart trial in 1990, July, in this famous medical journal called The Lancet, which really, this randomized trial proved, with something called quantitative angiography, that you could indeed actually reverse heart disease our number one killer of both men and women, with healthy plant-based diet and other lifestyle behaviors. Opening up arteries without drugs, without surgery. I mean, my family had seen it with their own eyes, but here it was kind of published, some of the most prestigious medical journals in the world. Yet when I got to medical school, I was shocked to find out that this whole body of evidence on reversing chronic disease with lifestyle changes was largely ignored by mainstream medicine. And so, like, if the cure to our number one killer, effectively, could get, you know, lost down the rabbit hole and ignored, I was thinking, you know, what else might there be out there buried in the medical literature that could help my patients? And so I kind of made it my life's mission to find out. That's what led me to start a website called nutritionfacts.org, and what led me to write the book, How Not to Die.
So you mentioned cardiovascular disease, which of course is our number one killer. And in the book, the first half of the book, you really go over almost a disease-specific roster of things that a plant-based diet can help us with in terms of prevention and really, you know, in many cases, there's evidence for, I should say, reversal of certain conditions. Now, it makes sense to me. I think it's arguably become somewhat intuitive that if you're a vegetarian and you don't eat, you know, high-fat foods or meats or things that are laden with cholesterol, that you're not going to develop atherosclerosis and block the arteries that feed your heart. But there's a number of conditions in there that, frankly, was surprising to me. For example, tell us about the science of nutrition as it pertains to dementia, because that's something that's very prevalent with our aging population, and that's quite frightening to any of us that are either caregivers for a loved one with dementia or as we age ourselves and become forgetful of certain things, we all worry. What's the science there?
Yeah, you know, that's, I was surprised as well. So, I mean, the book, you know, the first half of the book, the first 15 chapters are just the first 15 leading causes of death. Every year, the CDC compiles the top, you know, 15 killers. And so I just went through the list. And, you know, so my going into it, I was like, all right, I'm just going to look into the role diet may play in preventing, arresting, and reversing each of our 15 leading killers, knowing that a few of them, before I even went into the thing, were amenable. High blood pressure, type 2 diabetes, heart disease. But some of these other ones, like some of the mental health issues or cognitive health issues, Alzheimer's disease, dementia, that the same diet that could help these other organs also could help the brain as well. And so I was kind of surprised at first, but then I realized, well, I mean, there are certain commonalities. For example, the reason that a healthy diet can improve heart disease is because it improves blood flow. It opens up the arteries, clears out the arteries. And if you think about it, you know, many of our organ systems depend on a healthy blood flow, like our kidneys, like our liver, like our brain. And so if indeed, you know, you're increasing, enhancing blood flow to all the areas of the body, well, okay, well, then maybe that makes sense then that various organ systems, various types of diseases affecting all different types of the body would indeed be amenable to this kind of, you know, blood flow improving kind of diet and lifestyle. So what was surprising to me was that not only brain diseases like stroke, something called vascular dementia, where it's basically kind of a heart, a brain attack, a very similar kind of hardening of the arteries problems in the brain that one gets in the heart, but also diseases like Alzheimer's, dementia also seem to have a vascular component, meaning that if you treat vascular risk factors like high cholesterol, like high blood pressure, one may be able to reduce one's risk of not only Alzheimer's dementia, which is kind of like the end of the road of these diseases, but also even earlier on in the process in terms of what's called mild cognitive decline, where there's this kind of age-related loss of kind of mental function. Kind of all steps along the way, one appeared to be able to help prevent cognitive decline, slow cognitive decline. There was even a randomized trial with a few hundred Alzheimer's patients showing that you could slow the progression of the disease, again, by treating these vascular risk factors, showing that, you know, improving blood flow to the brain, whether it's somehow cleaning out whatever kind of toxins that build up or just providing oxygen or not sure exactly what's going on, but there did seem to be a relationship. And so that would explain this data going back decades now that from the Adventist Health Study, for example, that people that eat meat-free diets, plant-based diets, have between 2 to 3 times lower odds of becoming demented later in life. Some of that may be these kind of vascular dementias, but a piece of that may also be something like Alzheimer's dementia, which traditionally is not thought of as kind of a blood flow-related disease, but it does seem that lack of blood flow, the clogging of the arteries actually in our brains, may play a role in the development of these other types of dementia as well.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann, sitting in today for Rich Fisher. My guest is Dr. Michael Greger, who is the author of the best-selling book, How Not to Die, Discover the Foods Scientifically Proven to Prevent and Reverse Disease. He's also the founder of the website, nutritionfacts.org, all of which are a nonprofit. He donates all of his proceeds to charity. And we were talking about how a plant-based diet can seemingly, the evidence shows us, prevent or in some cases reverse certain disease processes. I was also surprised by the fact that you mentioned depression. Can you say a little bit more about that? I mean, how can a plant-based diet lessen depression?
We've known for a long time now that people that eat healthier tend to feel healthier, but these were so-called cross-sectional studies, a snapshot in time, and so we don't know the direction of causation, meaning we don't know if people that eat healthier go on to feel healthier, or people that are mentally healthy just tend to eat healthier, right? Who needs comfort foods if you don't need to be comforted? I mean, so we didn't know if diet really played a role, a causal role in mood, until we had our first interventional studies. In interventional studies where you take a group of people, split them up into two groups, and change, half their diets, or put them on two different types of diets, and see, keeping all other factors as constant as you can, see if that change in diet can actually affect people's mood. And when they did that, they found that indeed the same kind of plant-based diet could improve mood within 2 weeks, which was kind of extraordinarily quick. One thinks of these kind of classes of antidepressant drugs sometimes taking months for full effect. So to get a significant improvement in mood scores and anxiety scores within 2 weeks was quite extraordinary. Now, we're not sure why. The kind of hypothesis, the educated guess put forth by these University of Arizona researchers that did this interventional study was that it was something called arachidonic acid. There's this long chain inflammatory omega-6 fatty acid found predominantly in eggs and chicken in the American diet, but in animal products more broadly, that is kind of the precursor for many kind of inflammatory compounds in the body. That's how anti-inflammatory drugs like aspirin, ibuprofen work. They block the conversion of this arachidonic acid into these inflammatory mediators. And so they thought that maybe this arachidonic acid that people were eating was actually contributing to what they called neuroinflammation or inflammation in the brain, but we could evidently clear out this inflammation within a matter of weeks by cutting down our intake of eggs, chicken, and other meat. So they removed meat, fish, eggs, poultry, dairy from people's diet, got a significant boost in mood within weeks. So now this was, however, in a healthy population. So they went from kind of a normal mood to feeling even better. What we do not have as of yet is taking people who are clinically depressed. Those are the people that really need the boost in mood, change their diets, and see if we see a similar mood-boosting effect.
Yeah, an intervention trial. It'd be neat to have that done. So are you familiar with the Blue Zones? This is another sort
sure,
of outfit.
Dan Buettner. Wonderful work.
Yeah, so the Blue Zones, essentially, for listeners that aren't aware, there are these five communities across the world that Dan Buettner and his team went for National Geographic and found where people live the healthiest, the longest. And in places like Sardinia, or there's a Greek island, there's a town in Costa Rica, and where there's in Okinawa, Japan, and then Loma Linda, California. And one of the things I wanted to ask you, Dr. Greger, is that it seemed like they made the point repeatedly that the people in these communities live long and live healthy, but the perhaps surprising thing was they had heavily plant-based diets, but they did eat meat. And in fact, in I think four of the five communities, they actually drank a little bit of alcohol, very much in moderation, but a little bit. You know, how do you, I guess, reconcile the fact that in these five blue zones, or four out of the five blue zones, people are eating very small portions of meat, I mean, much less than the typical American diet, but does that jibe with your overall message?
Oh, no, absolutely. So when I talk about plant-based diets, I'm not talking about vegan, vegetarian diets. I'm talking about, you know, a predominance of whole plant foods. So that's what we see. So, for example, in Okinawa, probably the second longest living formally studied population, they eat, you know, 97% of their calories come from plant foods. And, you know, some of the longest living populations historically in sub-Saharan Africa, rural China, you know, they, you know, ate meat on special occasions, or they use meat as a condiment, as a flavoring, as opposed to what many of us eat in the Western world, which is where meat is the center piece of the plate. Right? It's got kind of a hunk of meat, and, you know, the plants are more like the garnish on the side. And so it's really a reversal of that. So what we see consistently throughout these long-living, healthy societies is that the predominance of their diet are these whole healthy plant foods. If there was one kind of common denominator Dan would talk about, it was bean consumption, legume consumption. So legumes are beans, split peas, chickpeas, and lentils. That was one thing that all of those populations, they ate vastly different diets, but the one thing they had in common was they ate a lot of beans. So that's one of the recommendations I make in my book based in part on that data.
They're definitely part of your daily dozen. What are some of the other elements of your daily dozen? Would you share with us?
Yeah, so I didn't want to just write a reference book. I also wanted to make it kind of a practical guide on translating this mountain of data into kind of day-to-day decisions. So the second half, so that's really what became kind of the second half of the book, where I centered my recommendations around this daily dozen checklist of all the things that I try to fit into my daily routine kind of over the years as I've done research. You know, there's just been a, you know, data building up about specific foods. Yes, in general, whole plant foods, you almost can't go wrong, but there are particular foods that seem to be even healthier than others. So, for example, fruit is healthy, but berries, it seems, are the healthiest fruits. Vegetables are all wonderfully healthy, but dark green leafy vegetables appear to have special attributes. So I kind of go through the list that, you know, we really should try to get berries into our daily diet, beans in our daily diet, greens into our daily diet, ground flax seeds. I talk about the healthiest beverages. Perhaps the kind of strangest recommendation is for a quarter teaspoon of turmeric, the yellow spice that makes curry powder yellow. There's actually dozens of clinical trials that have put this cheap, simple, convenient spice to the test against a variety of diseases. And we see these almost kind of pharmacological effects, and it seems to be remarkably safe at, you know, culinary doses. And so that's something that I started incorporating into my daily diet based on the evidence. And so that kind of makes the list as part of my daily dozen. And I think when people think of healthy foods, they think, oh, getting my vitamins and minerals. But they're actually, studies showing some of these foods, these individual foods can have these remarkable effects. So, for example, I talk about, you know, ground flax seeds. I recommend a tablespoon of ground flax seeds a day. Why? Because there are these randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled trials where you split people up into two groups and you give them a muffin that contains flax seeds or a placebo muffin, a muffin that doesn't contain flax seeds, so that and no one knows who's eating which muffin until the end. You break the code and you find out that eating ground flax seeds every day can bring down blood pressure 2 to 3 times better than our leading first-line blood pressure medications. And if you think about the side effects, they're good side effects, reducing the risk of breast cancer, prostate cancer, helping to control cholesterol and triglycerides and blood sugars, reducing inflammation, curing constipation. I mean, so it's like, wow, you get kind of the best of both worlds using some of these natural approaches. Not saying that there isn't a role for pills and procedures in modern medicine, but oftentimes, particularly for some of these chronic diseases, there are natural approaches one can try first to see if one can bring down some of these risk factors for some of our leading killers without having to get to the pharmacy.
I love that idea that the side effects of a healthier diet are, you know, positive side effects, things we wouldn't actually consider side effects but are just added benefits. I mean, that is a pretty powerful, I think, metaphor, actually. So critics of your work, so there are not that many that I could find, but there are some, of course. And some critics suggest that you cherry pick your data. And I will tell our listeners that the book, How Not to Die, is loaded with footnotes. So, I mean, it's very heavily footnoted and referenced with, you know, in your endnotes where you list all of the studies, the primary studies themselves that people can go look up for their own benefit. so this comment that I read online was, you know, that you're essentially picking information from small studies, studies that aren't as powerful, that you're cherry picking them for showing the maximal effect of vegetarianism, for example.
Well, I mean, I think it's important to realize there's only one diet that's ever been proven to reverse heart disease in the majority of patients. That's this plant-based diet. And, you know, as far as I'm concerned, look, if that's all a plant-based diet could do, reverse our number one killer, then shouldn't that be kind of the default diet until proven otherwise? And the fact that it can also be effective in treating, arresting, or reversing other leading killers like high blood pressure and type 2 diabetes would seem to make the case for this healthy plant-based living simply overwhelming, right? Only one diet has ever been proven to do that. So it's kind of hard to cherry-pick when there's only one cherry.
Okay, fair enough. And then the other criticism is not really much of a criticism, but just typical in that, and this is more, I would say, for my patient population, when I do a lot of reading on things like this and make suggestions, people say, oh, it's, you know, lifestyle change. Sure, it sounds good, but it's so hard. You know, I'm so used to the way I eat, or my family eats a certain way, or I'm going against years or even generations of tradition. How do you, obviously it's a process, but what do you say to people who refute your recommendations by saying it's, you know, lifestyle change is just too hard?
You know, I try to, it depends on the patient, but what I've done in the past is, you know, really try to bring it up as a trial. Like, let's give it a try. You know, I think it's hard for people to imagine, you know, a whole lifetime of, oh, I'm never going to eat pepperoni pizza again or something like that. I mean, that's just overwhelming. I mean, look, you've been living this way your whole life. But I said, okay, let's give it a try. You know, give me 3 weeks. You know, and so for example, I recommend there's this wonderful resource by a nonprofit organization called Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. They have a 21-day kickstart program. I think it's 21daykickstart.org. So basically, every month they run this free program. At the beginning of every month, a whole bunch of people get together. Hundreds of thousands of people have already done it. And it's basically a 3-week thing where they send you daily recipes and tips and things. And so it's just this, around this kind of healthy, kind of whole food, plant-based diet, and just for try it for 3 weeks. And then it's like, look, you know, you can do almost anything for 3 weeks. You know, so it's like, let's just give it a try, see what you think. You know, but let's go, you know, it's only a short time. You know, go all in. Instead of just putting your toe in the water or something, you know, just do it, you know, for, and then, you know, come back and tell me how you're doing. And now that's me being sneaky, because I realize by the time they come back, their taste buds will have started to change. And so, you know, natural foods will taste better than they ever have. They'll start feeling better often. You know, they'll be sleeping better, better digestion, better energy. Periods may get better. I mean, they have these kind of self-motivating benefits where then the motivation isn't coming from the outside. It isn't me telling them. It's their own body telling them. And then it's like, okay, let's do your labs before and after. You know, before I was going to recommend, put you on some cholesterol-lowering statin drug because your cholesterol is too high. But now you have choices. Now you see God, within just 3 weeks, we can bring down your cholesterol so low you don't need drugs anymore every day for the rest of your life. Or, so here's the risks and benefits of each of your options. And so it just shows you that you have tremendous control over your health and longevity. That's the good news. We all have this tremendous power, the vast majority of premature death and disability is preventable with a plant-based diet and other healthy lifestyle behaviors. And so I just try to, get people to make that first step. And then once they give it a try, only then can they really have all the information to make a decision about where they want to go in the future.
I really like that. Go all in for 3 weeks. I mean, that's something it does. You're right. It seems manageable. You're listening to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann, sitting in today for Rich Fisher. My guest is Michael Greger. He's the author of the best-selling book, How Not to Die, Discover the Foods Scientifically Proven to Prevent and Reverse Disease. He's also the founder of NutritionFacts.org, a website that is chock full of healthy nutrition videos, articles, links. Dr. Greger points out that all of his website proceeds and the proceeds from his book all go to charities. You at the outset talked about Nathan Pritikin. You've mentioned Dean Ornish, who's another pioneer in the field of nutrition as medicine. You also in the book talk a little bit about the famous Atkins group, named for Dr. Mm-hmm. Atkins, who, you know, people typically tend to hear about these diets. The famously, the Atkins diet was this you know, essentially try to zero out your carbohydrates, and you can then therefore eat protein and fat. And what it scientifically does is put your body in ketosis, so you actually do lose some weight. But typically, I think people's experience was they almost invariably gain the weight back. But there's sort of a story there in the book. Can you tell us about what happened with Atkins Nutritionals?
Yes, Atkins. Well, so I, 2002, I mean, there were 4 million people eating the Atkins diet, this kind of bacon and butter diet. And I was trying to tell people, you know, the goal is not to fit into a skinnier casket. I mean, the problem with dieting is, by definition, it is self-limited. We don't need to go on diets. We need to choose lifestyles that we can live with for the rest of our lives. And to do that, we need to choose one that's actually health promoting. And so it seemed like the opposite of direction that the kind of the global consensus of nutrition science had come to over the decades. And so I wrote a book called Carbophobia, and was sued the Atkins Nutrition company threatened to sue me for libel. For libeling Dr. Atkins and his name, his brand, and I was so amused by the threat that I posted it online at my AtkinsFacts.org website with kind of point by point rebuttals, and my publisher was drooling at the thought of being sued by Atkins. which would presumably give the book that much more exposure. But the lawsuit was dropped because poor Dr. Atkins died, and the company went bankrupt. And I mean, so they were not around to fulfill their threat to sue me. But it does. But there is so these so-called food libel laws, 21 states. That's how Oprah Winfrey got into problems. She had some guests on the show that talked to her about some of the meat industry practices. She says, I'm never going to eat a burger again. The cattle futures on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange plummeted, and this cattle rancher in Amarillo, Texas, lost a lot of money, and so sued Oprah under this food disparagement laws, where you can't say, quote-unquote, unfounded comments against perishable food items. And so I was honored to be kind of called into that, to be kind of an expert witness, saying that, no, indeed, these were founded comments. But thankfully, I wasn't... that testimony wasn't necessary because she won on First Amendment grounds, which is the precedent we really wanted to set, but it took her 8 years. People don't realize that these appeals went back and forth for 8 years at a cost of who knows how much money. And so in the end, she triumphed. But in a sense, one could say, actually, it was the industry that won because of the silencing effect. If you can drag one of the most powerful, richest people in the world through the courts for 8 years, I mean, it doesn't matter what the final verdict was. It shows that just the kind of threat of lawsuits by these powerful food corporations, might make media entities think twice about doing some kind of expose about, the next food safety issue or food additive or something. So it's important to realize that there is this kind of gagging effect it can have on a discourse about healthy food in this country.
Well, Michael Greger, congratulations on the success of the book. It's a runaway bestseller. How Not to Die is the name of the book. Discover the food scientifically proven to prevent and reverse disease. And if you're interested, you can certainly learn more at his website, nutritionfacts.org. Michael Greger, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, that's our show for today. Studio Tulsa on Health is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. To listen to our show anytime or follow up on any of our interviews, check out our website, studiotulsa.org. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.